This is Let's Talk Business with your host, Mark Ebinger. Now, here's Mark.
Welcome to Let's Talk Business, the show that highlights and promotes entrepreneurs to learn more about their vision, goals, and marketing strategy. Coming up on the show today, we're going to talk about making it in the country music business as a singer-songwriter. In studio with us today is Tom Shepard, who's written 5 number one songs, had 2 songs nominated for Grammys, and CMA of Texas Songwriter of the Year. Tom, excited to have you here. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me. I'm glad I met you.
I'm your host, Mark Ebinger, the owner of Krukus Virtual Staffing, a company that specializes in hiring virtual assistants from outside the United States.
I am Heather Baim, business coach and trainer with Onset Professional Development, where we take the should-do things in your business and make them will-do.
And I'm Kian Frith, the CEO of KV Impact Consulting, CFO consultant, and I help business leaders realize their dreams.
Yes, you do. Helping me realize mine. The advice you're giving me is fantastic. And the way that you actually communicate with my wife during our sessions is very good. Also, Heather is my coach as well. And I think sometimes you guys are kind of like marriage counseling in some ways.
Nope.
A little bit. unofficial.
Well, it would be if it looked like you were listening, but Jennifer listens and engages in the conversation.
I'm listening, I just don't look like it.
I start talking about numbers and you switch off.
Oh, yeah.
Or I just start talking and because I'm English, you switch off.
Tom, are you a numbers guy?
Not really. Sort of. Only because I have to be.
Yeah.
See, in our session, it's the other way around. Like, me and Mark start talking and Jennifer's like...
Yeah, she checks out a little
and
bit.
Then we have to pull her back in and be like, all right, what do you think of that? And she's like, let me rein you guys in on the vision.
Rock and roll.
To
everybody's
the
got their preferences, man. All right, a quick reminder to follow the Let's Talk Business podcast on all major podcast platforms and social media where you can catch video versions of the show. You can get to everything easily from our website at satalkradio.com. Now, if you're going to be in the San Antonio area on Thursday, May 16th, be sure to join us at the next Let's Talk Business Mega Mixer. We're expecting at least 150 local business owners and entrepreneurs on site to mix, mingle, and connect with each other to do more business. You can get to all the information on our website at satalkradio.com. Now, a quick shout-out for the Right Guys Plumbing. They're one of our gold sponsors for the event, which really helps facilitate, so we got plenty of beverages and plenty of food and plenty of fun going on. Well, you look like you want to say something.
I'm just thinking, you're just making sure you've got enough margarita because you ran out of the last mixer.
Yes, we did.
Because this is a mega mixer, you need a mega amount of margarita.
Thank you. Yeah, so a quick shout out to the Right Guys Plumbing here in San Antonio. They are the San Antonio plumbing experts. They can help you with water heater replacement, water softener, installation or replacement, and 24-hour emergencies. Now, they are 5-star rated with over 125 reviews, and Tito, who owns the place, is a friend of mine. He's done plumbing work and installed our water heater at our place. You can reach them, that's the Right Guys Plumbing, at 210-744-4397. That's 210-744-4397, and ask for Tito, have him come out and give you a hand. That's the Right Guys Plumbing. All right, so Tom, excited to have you here. We met at an event, like a big luncheon, and I'm super excited. You're my first singer that we've had in the show.
That's good.
So we're kind of like figuring it out as we go. So tell me a little bit about your background, what led you to the country music industry.
Well, I grew up, in St. Louis, Missouri, and my family played. My mom's uncle played pedal steel guitar, and sometimes we would have, these jams in our basement. And my dad picked up the guitar, when I was probably in, elementary school. And he always encouraged me to learn to play, but I never got interested till I was a senior in high school. And so I started picking it up. And at the same time, I was working for a guy, and we would listen to country music on the radio all day. At that time, I liked country, but I wasn't really listening to it all the time. My parents listened to Glenn Campbell and, stuff like that. But when I started working for that guy, I started listening all day long and fell in love with, like, Randy Travis and George Strait, Dwight Yoakam, and people like that. And as I was learning to play the guitar, I just learned all their songs. And then I, went off to college and started playing in some local bands and things like that. And then I decided to give Nashville a shot.
I know you've had some breakout hits. Which one are you going to play for us at the start of the show here?
I think Riding with Private Malone. That was the first big hit that I ever had as a songwriter.
Okay, awesome.
In 2001.
Love it. Let's gear him up so he can play.
All right. Let's see here. Yeah, David Ball is the guy that recorded this song, and it was my first number one. was just out of the service, thumbing through the classifieds, when an ad said old Chevy somehow caught my eye. The lady didn't know the year or even if it ran, but I had that $1,000 in my hand. Well, it was way back in the corner of this old ramshackle barn, with 30 years of dust and dirt on that green army tarp. And when I pulled that cover off, it took away my breath, 'cause what she called Chevy was a 66 Corvette. And I felt a little guilty as I counted out the bills. Well, what a rush I got when I sat behind the wheel. Opened up the glove box, that's when I found the note. The date was 1966, and this is what he wrote. It said, "My name is Private Andrew Malone, and if you're reading this, then I didn't make it home. But for every dream that shatters, there's another that comes true. And this car was once a dream of mine, now it belongs to you. And though you may take her and make her your own, you'll always be riding with Private Malone." Well, it didn't take me long at all, I had her running good. I love to hear those horses thunder underneath the hood. I had her shining like a diamond, and I'd put that ragtop down, and the pretty girls would stop and stare as I drove her through the town. The buttons on the radio didn't seem to work quite right, but it picked up that oldies show, and especially late at night. I'd get feeling sometimes, if I turn real quick, I'd see a soldier riding a shotgun in the seat right next to me. A young man named Private Andrew Malone, who fought for his country, never made it home. But for every dream that shatters, there's another that comes true. And this car was once a dream of his, back when it was new. And he told me to take her and make her my home. And I was proud to be riding with Private Malone. One night on a rain slick road, I took a curve too fast, and I still don't remember much about that fiery crash. Someone said they thought they saw a soldier pull me out. Oh, they didn't get his name, but I know without a doubt it was a young man named Private Andrew Malone, who fought for his country and never made it home. But for every dream that shatters, there's another that comes true. And this car was once a dream of his, back when it was new. And I know I wouldn't be here if he hadn't tagged along. Yeah, that night I was riding with Private Malone. Oh, thank God I was riding with Private Malone.
Great job, man.
That was awesome.
Thank you.
I love that story. Well, I got goosebumps twice.
I know. It was fun to
listen. Yeah, thank you. That song has been such a blessing. I just can't tell y'all. I could spend the whole show talking just about that song.
You know? So talk about the...
I want to know the background.
Yeah, a little bit of the background on the song, because you wrote it.
I did.
Tell us about that.
Well, you know, I had... I moved to Nashville, and I was, you know, working on being a songwriter full-time. I finally got a songwriting job, right? And I was there for 2 years. Well, in that two-year time period, I didn't get any songs, hit songs recorded by anybody. So after 2 years, they said, we got to let you go. But my boss said, you know, we don't have the budget, but you know what? The door's open. If you want to come in the office and write songs on your days off, you know, because I had to go back to the day job, right? Mm-hmm. So he said, the door's open if you want to use the office. And I was like, great. So one day I was in there and he said, I want to challenge you to write a song that only you care about. Like, stop trying to write a hit. You know, like, yeah, but I got to make a living. He's like, stop trying to write a hit. Write something that means something to you. And I was like, all right, I love old cars. I want to write a song about an old car. And the story I've always heard is, you know, the guy that finds the car in the barn for sale. Mm-hmm. And it's super cheap and it's some awesome car. So I thought, okay, I'll start with that. And then there was another story I heard about a guy that had bought a used car and felt like it was haunted. Like he thought maybe there was a presence in the car or the radio station would be on the wrong channel when he got in, you know, and stuff.
I saw that movie. It's called Christine.
Yeah, and one of the lines in the song about the buttons on the radio didn't work right, that's inspired by that movie, Christine. Very good, Mark. You picked up on that.
Been around a minute.
Yeah, so... anyway, that's all I had, and I didn't really know where to go with it. So several months later, maybe a year later, I went to visit my dad. At that time, my parents had moved to Virginia, and I had worked for this guy there named Bill Madigan who had a picture framing shop at his house in my senior year. And so I sold him my first car. So I hadn't been to visit him in a long time, and on this particular visit back to see my dad, I said, man, I haven't seen Bill. It's probably 12, 13 years. I feel like we should go see him today. I don't know why. I just feel like let's go visit him. So we got there and I said, hey, what'd you ever do with that car I sold you? He's like, oh, still got it. It's down behind the barn. I go, can we go look at it? And he goes, well, my nephew took the motor out and it's just kind of, you know, we just parked it. So we went down there, walked around the corner of that barn and it was like seeing a dead relative decomposing in the field because I loved that car when I had it. It was a 64 Chevrolet station wagon, and it was bright red with a white roof. And so we were looking around the car, and I took the Chevy logo off the front, took that home with me. And I thought, I wonder if I left anything in the glove box, because like I sold it as is. I didn't even clean it out or anything.
Oh, wow.
And I, sure enough, there was like the registration from 1987 and, you know, some papers and junk, you know. And there was these two little books in there that my dad had kept in there, like little like notepads for like keeping track of his maintenance, mileage, all that. And one of them looked like a little black diary. And I thought, oh wow, what if this was a diary from the guy who had this car in the 60s? And what if it wasn't a station wagon? What if it was a cool car? And what if it was the guy's dream car? What if he left a note in the diary for the next guy that finds the car if he doesn't make it back? And, you know, I mean, without the note in the glove box, I don't think the song would have ever gone anywhere or it had the impact. That note in the glove box is that's one of the most important parts of the song.
There's another big hit song about if you get there before I do.
Don't forget. Yeah.
So it has that same kind of vibe to it.
Yeah.
Which I think is very, very cool. So
I love story songs. That's what I love about country music. It's the stories.
I mean, that was something we were talking about when we were waiting to come in this morning, wasn't it? It's just, you know, when you go and do your gigs, your concerts, a lot of time you prefer just doing on your own because you're telling a story.
Yeah, to me, these days, it's like the story is half of the show. But people love to hear the story. That's the best. That's the magic part. You know, you hear these songs and you wonder, where do they come from?
So when you wrote that song and it's based on story, did that then inspire you then with the way that you're going to approach your further songwriting?
Oh, yeah, totally, because what it inspired was instead of chasing something, like chasing what was on the radio, it's like, well, hey, if I write a song that means something just to me that I don't think, oh, I don't know if this will be on the radio, that it can happen. You know, same thing. The second big number one I had was a song called Redneck Yacht Club. And at the time when my co-writer pitched me the idea, I was like, that. I like it. It's a good title, but, you know, nobody's really doing that on the radio right now because, like, Nashville had gotten kind of pop country-ish, you know, with mm-hmm. Rascal Flatts and Keith Urban and things. And I was like, maybe we should write, if we want to keep our job as a songwriter, we're going to have to write some of that pop-ish music. Mm-hmm. But then at the same time, I was like, yeah, but when you write what means something to you, hell, let's just write it. So we wrote it, and sure enough, again, second time, a song I thought, this isn't, they're not really doing this on the radio right now. Same with Private Malone. That song is almost 5 minutes long, and that's rare for radio singles. Most are around 3 minutes long. So a lot of stations don't play stuff that's too long. I mean, that's a strike against you for trying to get your song on the radio.
Well, talk about how it ended up being sung by the guy David Ball.
Well, David Ball, so I wrote the song with a guy named Wood Newton. And Wood and David and I were on a radio show one night. I had never met them, but it was on WSM Radio, the home of the Grand Ole Opry. And they did a show on Friday nights called Opry Star Spotlight. It was kind of like this, you know, mm-hmm. people sitting around a table, taking turns singing, and they would interview you, and it would go out on WSM. So I was there one night, and I met Wood and David, and Wood said, we should write sometime. He said, I like your songs because they're country, but they're not dumb.
or overly depressing, you know what I mean?
Right. I don't like sad stuff. But so we wrote the song. As it turns out, he was producing David Ball at the time. So when we finished the song, I said, hey, wouldn't it be cool if we went back on WSM and debuted the song that we wrote because we met on their show? And I said, why don't you ask David if he wants to come along since he was there when we met? So he came along, and that night, March 23rd, 2001, I played it on the show, and there was a bunch of people in the, you know, in the little studio. There was probably a dozen people in there. I hit the last note. There was a second of silence, and then the room just exploded with applause, and everybody was like, and the host of the show was like, where did that song come from? Oh, my God. Wow. And just right then, I was like, I think we got something here.
And so did David say, hey, I want to sing this?
David said, I want to put this on my next record. And I was like, you mean the one? He was just finishing one up. And I'm like, the one that's almost done? He's like, no, that one's done. The next one, I go, well, that's going to be like, who knows, 2 years from now. But they ended up changing the artwork for the record. They ended up going in and adding it to the record at the like last 11th hour just because they knew it was going to be something big. And it was the only hit on that record.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Awesome. Oh, I love that.
So if I'm dying to know, how does that translate into money? How do you get paid on that? How does that work?
Well, you have to be a member of either ASCAP, BMI, or CSAC, and they keep track of all of our royalties, you know, that are paid out all over the world. They keep track of that. There's no way you could do it yourself.
No.
So you never know how much you're going to get. Like, there's no way to, like, forecast it or anything. You just kind of go, well, hope it does good. And I mean, the very first check that I got in my mailbox, I walked down there and I knew it was coming. I had no idea how much it was going to be. It was for $60,000.
Whoa!
That was the first one. And you get paid on a song. When you're a songwriter, you get paid for the life of the song. People say, do you sell your songs? People always say, have you sold many of your songs? Like, no, I don't sell my songs. That'd be dumb. You license them because it's for the life of the thing, right? It's like renting a house or selling a house. If you sell a house, you get the money and you're done. If you rent a house, you rent it till you die. You know, it's like it's ongoing passive income, which is great for your business. So it's pretty amazing.
He's talking my language, passive income. And,
yeah.
You put it in a trust and it goes to your family on and on.
Yeah,
and on.
Actually, the rights to the song belong to you for 75 years past your death.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So, yeah, but most people, you know, assign it to their kids or whatever.
So what did that look like? Because you went from, like, not even having a job as a songwriter at the time right. to basically overnight success.
Yeah.
What shifted? What did you have to learn to be able to handle that kind of money, attention?
Well, the first thing I learned, and this is very important, was that when I got that $60,000 check, I did the math. I took 30% of it out and put it in a separate account and said, that's not my money.
That's taxes.
That's taxes. Money. I don't want to get behind or that whatever. Was. And I would do that every year. And yeah, you have to do that.
So if you had to guess, how much do you think that that song made you over, from then until now? Just
probably close to $500,000.
Nice.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
And probably about the same for Redneck Out Club. You know,
that's pretty cool.
So, and it depends on, you know, there's also, without getting too complicated, there's, you know, the songwriter's share, there's the publisher's share, right? So usually you write for a company and they pay you to write, but it's in advance, you know? So they get half the money, you get half the money. Well, at the time, like I told you, I didn't have a deal. So if you don't have a publishing deal, you get all of it.
Nice, yeah.
So I got a full 50%.
So somebody was looking down on you.
Yes, yes.
You did with other songwriting and didn't happen. Just, wow, I love
it. It's true, it's true. And it's, there's been a lot of that, you know. I mean, over the years I've recognized there's so much magic to it. There's so much serendipity and right place, right time, when things are supposed to happen. You know, I mean, when that song got, when Private Malone got recorded, David Ball was 47 and he was on a small little label that was an independent label. You know, he didn't have the, they didn't have the financial backing to promote a song at radio. You know, people say, oh, payola is legal with radio. You can't pay to have your songs played on the radio. It's how it works, y'all. It's
interesting.
You can't say, hey, hey, Mark, I'm going to give you $10,000 to come on my to play my song on your station. That's illegal. But I could say, hey, Mark, how would you like it if I sent 10 of your listeners on a cruise to Mexico if you'll play my song on there? But I'm not giving this to you. I'm giving it to 10 of your listeners.
Hmm. Yeah. So that's interesting that you can't get paid to go on a radio and sing a song. I don't. That didn't make any sense to me.
Well, I mean, I'm just saying you can't like bribe people to play, but to have them.
I think the radio can pay you to pay. Play? Can they? Can they?
No, they don't. No. Well, they just pay their ASCAP and BMI dues that they have to pay for all the songs they use, and then ASCAP and BMI doles it out to the writers.
Interesting. Yeah.
Now, two questions, if I may. That first $60,000 check, have you framed it?
No, I didn't.
No, he cashed it.
Yeah. He's the kind of guy that has his first dollar framed.
I have a lot of friends that have gotten checks for 30 cents or a dollar or something. I think I probably have one somewhere.
Frame that one, right? That'll keep you humble. There's my 30 cent check.
When you see the 30 cent check, at least you go, at least I know the channels are open and they're working.
I'm ready to receive.
Costs more to mail that check.
Right.
The other thing I'm thinking is that if that Riding with Private Malone hadn't taken off, you were not under a contract at that point. You've gone back to a day job, whatever that was.
Yeah.
If that song hadn't made it, what would you have done?
I don't know. I think I probably would have kept slugging away and writing songs because that's what I love doing, you know, writing and performing and doing shows, you know. Luke Combs has a song called, you know, people ask me what I'd be doing if I wasn't doing this. I'd be doing this. Yeah. You know, it's like whether I would be doing it on a large scale or a small scale, probably still be doing this.
So it kind of like becomes just part of who you are. Like,
you
can't walk away from it.
No, it's a lifestyle, really. I mean, I think
that's the thing though that I kind of wanted to ask about because I'm a little bit more on the pragmatic side, not the creative side. Right. I think everybody knows that. But the entertainment industry is a great example of getting constantly rejected. And in sales and business, we talk about how you have to get back up from the knockdowns. Mm. So tell us a little bit about your mindset in the, like, I'm just going to keep doing it, whether I succeed or fail until I succeed.
Yeah. You have to. That's it. You have to. You hear no a lot. And I remember friends of mine who didn't have a writing deal going, man, I wish I could get a songwriting job. You know, I'm tired of getting told no all the time. I'm like, you want to get told no on a more consistent basis? Get a publishing deal, because when you're in, now when they're paying you and you're playing songs from them, they're going, nope, we can't spend money on that one. Nope. You just go, okay, whatever, and you just keep after it.
Is that something that just came natural to you, or did you have to work through some issues with the rejection?
I just kept doing it because I'm like, this is what I want to do. Whatever it costs, this is what I'm doing. You know?
And do you still have friends back in Nashville who are going through this day in, day out, and they've been doing it far longer than you, maybe, of just day in, day out and being rejected, and never made it?
I know a lot of people that put in 20, 25 years and still, they're still hanging in there. I mean, but one of my friends, he was there probably 18 years before he got his first big hit, and he had a number one hit. And I'm so happy for him.
Yeah, for sure.
But it's interesting. In those situations, people go, oh, it's overnight success.
No.
It's taken 18, 20, 25 years to get to this point.
It does. It takes a lot of lead up to it, you know, a lot of...
Mm-hmm. So does it frustrate you now when you see some of these youngsters? We were talking about TikTok earlier.
Yeah.
You know, these youngsters, they go onto TikTok and then it all goes viral. Then they get signed up. You're like, whoa, wait a minute. We've been working at this for years and years and never discovered what's going on here.
Yeah.
And has it then helped you to maybe go, actually, we're going to pivot. We're going to do things differently.
Yeah, it makes me think I need to get on damn TikTok.
Yeah, I think you definitely should. Oh, I've got a question. Speaking of things that bother you, I was listening to the radio station the other day, and I heard a song, a country song, and it sounded so familiar to the songs I grew up listening to in the 90s and early 2000s, but it wasn't.
Yeah.
Does that bother you? Because it bothers me. It's basically like taking our classics, you know, your Gretchen Wilson, your Rascal Flatts,
right,
and the exact same beat, tone, some of the same words, and just...
There's a couple recently. There's a... Lainey Wilson did a song called Watermelon Moonshine, and it's the exact same melody as Craig Morgan's song, That's What I Love About Sunday.
Yep.
Exactly the same melody and everything. And from what I heard, they actually ended up giving the original writers a piece of that song because of it was so...
It's like they're
clearly
trying to trick us.
You know, the same thing.
This has been around.
I think
Vanilla Ice did it with one of the Queen songs.
Oh, yeah.
But that's the thing. It's not like their interpretation of that song.
Yeah.
It is almost the exact same song, and you start singing along to it, and then it's different, and you're like, but wait, what? Like, those aren't the words. It's
right.
Weird.
There was a guy, there's a guy named Jelly Roll who's really popular right now, and he just put out a song. They took the song Drift Away. You know, the Dobie Gray song, Give Me the Beat, Boys, Free My Soul.
Yep.
It's the same exact intro lick and everything. They took the entire song and just wrote all new words to it. And that, yeah, I don't think that's right. I don't like that. It's like, give me something original.
Yeah.
Give me something new.
Well, they got to pay for it, I would imagine. I know Vanilla Ice had to pay out. But
sure.
I think that is like one of the top-selling songs ever when it comes to maybe rap, R&B or whatever, was Vanilla Ice, which is crazy. It sold like over 2 billion records last time.
Yeah. Or like the Kid Rock thing, you know, he did All Summer Long.
Yes.
And he had to pay the writers of Sweet Home Alabama, and he had to pay the writers of Werewolves of London because it used that dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum. It's the same lick, so...
Everybody's making money.
That
sounds
was
like
a good small,
thing to me.
That, everybody's piece of the pie on that one was like a sliver because there were so many writers that had to be paid out of that.
Yeah. No, I love all that. So you got a something you do. Is it every year you do the Lone Star?
Yeah, Lone Star Luau.
Yeah.
This is year 7. We're getting ready to do it in about 2 weeks.
So what was the inspiration for that? How did that come about? And it, well, tell us what it is first and then go back to inspiration.
Well, it's a music festival, and it is a 4-day event. It happens at Margaritaville Lake Resort in Lake Conroe, just north of Houston. And we got about, I think, 15 or so acts. and it's a mix of songwriters, Texas music artists, and people who do trop rock music, which trop rock is like short for tropical rock.
Yeah.
Basically, it's Jimmy Buffett music.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But it's people that do their own original music that's kind of islandy or beachy or fun. And so my wife, Coley, and I have kind of been in all three of those genres in the last several years. Obviously, we're songwriters and country music. And we moved to Austin in 2011, and we toured here a lot. So we've been in the Texas music scene. But also, we've kind of done a lot of things for Jimmy's fans, the Parrotheads. Since 2007. So, you know, we're kind of in three worlds. And my idea was with the Luau was let's bring them all together. Because it seems to me like it's the same type of fan that goes to all three different kinds of shows. You know, I mean, we would go to the Larry Joe Taylor's Music Fest in Stephenville. And we've played on a thing called the Music Fest in Steamboat for the last 10 years. And been to a ton of, like, singer-songwriter, you know, festivals and things. So we wanted to kind of do all of our own, do one of our own and kind of pick and choose and go, I like that guy from that festival, and I like that guy from that festival. And I know that our Jimmy Buffett fans will actually like this Texas group, and I know our Texas people will probably like this guy that does beach music. So that's kind of why we put it all together is because, you know, that and because, you know, we want to do something that, you know, do one big thing a year and take the rest of the year off. Which it's not. Yeah. It's not.
Does
not
it ever work
yet.
Out that way?
We're not
yeah.
there yet. But
well, how big is it now? How many people show up to these things?
We've had as many as 600.
Okay.
Oh. Yeah.
And so RVs type stuff, did I get that idea from your website? Like there's RV parking?
Yeah. My wife and I thought it'd be a great idea to move into an RV full time and just tour the country for 3 years. We did that a few years ago. So around the time that we did the first luau. So we said, oh, there's got to be RV parking, you know? And so the first few years, there was quite a few. Lately, it's not as many RVs. Most people just stay in the resort because it's really nice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's glamping.
Yeah.
I like to stay in the hotels too.
Yeah.
So what's the connection with Jimmy Buffett other than, is it different than what you say? Because there was a part about asking you about Jimmy Buffett. Is there some history?
Yeah. Well, you know, when I was in college, I was in a duo with a guy and all he knew were Jimmy Buffett songs. That's it. So we would, you know, basically play back and forth on campus. I would do whatever I was playing everything from like Garth to Merle Haggard to R.E.M. to Chris Isaac, you know, Bonnie Raitt. I mean, we were playing whatever was popular in the early 90s. Mm-hmm. That's what I was playing, and he was playing Jimmy Buffett songs. And then moved to Nashville, got a gig, and there was this friend of mine named Gary, and he would show up every time and go, hey, you know this Jimmy Buffett song? Would you learn it? So I started learning more. And then in 2007, I got invited to play a songwriter festival called Six String Music in New Orleans. And it was all parrot heads. It was all people that do trap rock, that do nothing but beach music. And I kind of fell in with them because they loved the songwriter aspect, but I had a lot of party and drinking songs. And then the more I played shows for them, I started writing more beach songs and ended up with a song called Always Saturday Night. They got played on Radio Margaritaville, Jimmy's station on XM, Sirius XM. So it's just kind of grown and grown and grown from there. So that's kind of how it all started. So, you know, it's like there's so much great music in that genre, and it's just people don't seem to really know about it. It's not well publicized.
So are you a fan of Gordon Lightfoot too, by chance?
Yeah, Gordon Lightfoot, great songwriter.
Another story songwriter kind of guy. You know,
he inspired Jimmy.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I did not know that.
Yeah. I heard an interview with him, with Jimmy, where he said he got to meet Gordon Lightfoot and said, man, I just want to thank you for what you did for me as a writer. I wanted to be you when I started.
Oh.
And he said, I think you've done okay, Jimmy. Just pass it on to the next guy.
I like story songwriter types. Jim Taylor.
James Taylor. Amazing.
Probably the best, the most well-known, mm-hmm. right? I'd like to be getting his checks in the mail, right?
No kidding, yeah. Pop songs make a lot more than country songs. I mean, country songs make a lot, but I wouldn't mind having a pop hit.
Seeing how that goes. Do you think the biggest moneymaker in music is? Is it the royalty checks or is it the touring?
The touring?
Where does it come from?
Well, I would say if you're a songwriter and you write a lot of hits, probably the publishing side of things. It's that mailbox money.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you write the songs and there's, you know, you get paid. I mean, you get paid from the airplay. Whereas if you're touring, you know, you have the expense of a band and a tour bus and a... Mm-hmm. And equipment and all that kind of a thing, but it just depends on the level. I mean, my wife just wanted to see, what is Taylor Swift worth? She looked it up yesterday.
Oh, it's like
billions. Like 1.1 billion.
Yeah.
That's all? Seems like she'd be in the trillions by now as much as she's on TV.
So, I don't know. I mean, but the touring is, if you're on that level, it's up there too.
Did you go into it knowing you wanted to go the songwriting route, or did you want to be a big touring performer initially?
No, I wanted to be George Strait. I wanted to be Garth Brooks. I wanted to be on stage. That was my thing. I loved playing and singing. And when I got to town, when I got to Nashville, everybody's like, oh, you got to write. You have to write your own stuff. That's what will set you apart and make you unique as a person, as a songwriter, as an artist. You have to have your own thing that nobody else is saying, you know. Also, if you're not, you know, the greatest singer, I'm not exactly Pavarotti, you know what I'm saying? But I have a lot of songs that are really cool, and it doesn't matter. I mean, there's a lot of famous, especially in Texas music, I feel like there's a lot of famous musicians that were not amazing singers. Well, even Jimmy Buffett, really, if you listen to Jimmy, he doesn't have a huge, awesome range, you know what I mean? But he sings his songs great, and he brings his thing to the table, and that's it. So,
well, that audience connection is real huge, too. You
know? Yeah.
People love that. I mean, once they love you, they're going to keep you around for a long time.
It's true. You know, I moved to Nashville to try to get a record deal and to work on that. Never happened for me. Ended up being more of a songwriter, but I still had that desire to want to tour and perform and play my songs for people. I know there are people out there that like what I do. I've met them. Mm-hmm. You know, I've done shows for them. I know there's a whole lot of people out there. I got to go find them. So in 2011, I was kind of burned out on the writing thing. I'd just done it for several years and was just kind of fried doing it all the time. And I thought, I want to give the touring thing a shot. If I can't get a Nashville deal, I'm going to do it on my own. And I knew a guy named Kevin Fowler. I'd written a bunch of songs with him in Texas. And I was like, man, Kevin, you got this tour bus and all these fans. And let me get this straight. You don't have a record deal? He's like, nope. We're just out here working, doing it, and doing it well. I was like, okay, I want to do that. So in 2011, I left Nashville, moved to Austin, and just started performing around Texas. And that's how I ended up here.
Well, now you sing a lot of cover songs and your own stuff on TikTok. Sing it live right into the phone and get that out. And
that's all I need to do, right?
Well, people are doing well at it. It leads to gigs. It leads to all
about
kind
the
of
posting.
Stuff.
Yeah.
So we're going to wrap up the regular section, and we'll go into the after show. But if people want to get in touch with you, Tom, how do they do that?
My name is spelled T-H-O-M-S-H-E-P-H-E-R-D, Tom Shepherd. No A's in it. you can just look me up. It's TomShepherd.com. I'm on Facebook. It's Tom Shepherd Music. But everywhere else, TikTok is Tom Shepherd, and Instagram is Tom Shepherd. So that's it pretty much.
Hey, YouTube. You got a YouTube channel.
YouTube.com/Tom Shepherd.
Awesome.
So a lot of content on there.
All right, Tom. Well, thanks. Now, stick around for the after show. It'll be for our Patreon subscribers. But other than that, thanks again for coming out. As we wrap up the show, a quick reminder to check out our latest podcast and catch video version of the show anytime by visiting our website at satalkradio.com. That's going to be it for us. Thanks, everybody. Have a great week.
Thank you.
Good job.